Ukraine remains at the top of the list. And the reason that Ukraine remains at the top of the list, almost more important than, you know, minus domestic issues, is Ukraine is a enormous enabler for Russian power. I think we can muddle through with a status quo with China in this kind of current relationship. There's a coalescing of views with our allies on the kinds of threats China poses. China at times recognizes that its assertiveness has been counterproductive, and you could muddle through, but to lose Ukraine right now would be in a lot of ways a geopolitical game changer, because of this whole notion, and I think Zbigniew Brzezinski kind of said it best, is Russia with Ukraine automatically becomes a geopolitical power, an empire.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 9th, 2021. Tensions are heating up between Russia and Ukraine 7 years after the seizure by the Russians of the Crimean Peninsula and the incursions into eastern Ukraine. There have been troop movements. There's been a certain amount of saber rattling. Is Vladimir Putin trying to send a message to Joe Biden? Is he trying to satisfy domestic constituencies or distract them? Is he trying to send a message to Ukrainian President Zelensky? What's going on here? To talk about it all, I asked Alexander Vindman to join me in the virtual jungle studio to go over all of the ins and outs. What is Russia doing and why? And what is the Biden administration doing about it? What should it be doing? It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 9th. Alex Vindman on the escalation in Ukraine.
Alex, I'd like to start with just an overview of the heightened tensions that are developing between Russia and Ukraine and what's happening and why it's happening now. Can you give us a sort of, for those who have not followed the news closely, what is happening that is the source of concern here?
Sure. And I'll start with kind of the once over, maybe migrate into, you know, what the Russians are doing, the Ukrainians are doing, and the U.S. is doing. It's interesting that we could have a conversation about Ukraine and your listeners actually know where it is on the map. That would not have been the case less than a decade ago. I guess Russia, in one regard, has been successful about putting itself and Eurasia back on the map by mischief making in that part of the world. But I would say we could pinpoint the beginning of this whole affair with Russia's resurgence, underpinned in the 2000s by high oil and gas prices and the ability to invest resources into security services and defense apparatus. And in so doing, enabling its return to, you know, a standard toolkit of coercive tactics. And those coercive tactics for the Russians have traditionally been political, informational, economic, and then when it needs to, certainly military and law enforcement. And having failed to keep the Ukrainians in its orbit, when able, all of the you know, former territories that the Russians and Soviet Union controlled want to assert their independence and sovereignty when they can, and you know, with Russia's kind of diminishing influence, they have to eventually, you know, fall back on military means. So in 2013, then President Viktor Yanukovych had to make a decision about whether he was going to pursue kind of the interests and the will of the people and sign an association agreement with the EU, or succumb to pressure from Vladimir Putin and join the Eurasian Economic Union and, you know, cast aside the hopes of prosperity and Euro-Atlantic integration for the Ukrainians. That resulted in, you know, widespread unrest, large-scale protests, and the consequent crackdown by the Ukrainian security apparatus, which hewed very closely to kind of the Russian format at that time. And that, in effect, had a consequent reaction, which was larger protests, more violence, and ultimately Viktor Yanukovych fled Ukraine and settled in Russia, was welcomed with open arms by Vladimir Putin, settled in Russia. And the Russians first seized the peninsula, the Crimean Peninsula, where they had a very, very large military presence, both Black Sea Fleet, naval infantry, air power, which they've drastically increased over the subsequent years, and then a war, a proxy war would be a kind description, because this was a purely Russian enterprise.
More war than proxy.
Yes. To say that these were separatists is a wide departure from the truth. But basically, you know, take a very, very small kind of fringe element with, you know, not necessarily nationalist interests, but other kind of interests, economic benefits and power and so forth, and organized crime and so forth, and kind of organize them into some sort of separatist movement that was entirely backed and supported by the Russian state. You know, that's basically how that the war in eastern Ukraine started, and it's continued. At one point, when the Ukrainians kind of got past their initial shock with the fact that they were attacked by the Russians, which, you know, the brotherly state of Russia, they would never had considered that a possibility. It was a nearly bloodless seizure of Crimea, but the subsequent effort to start a war in eastern Ukraine to secure more territory. At the time, they were thinking about establishing like Nova Russia, expanding Russian territory in that regard through this, you know, nationalist Russian, ethnic Russian enterprise, which failed. And the Ukrainians, you know, once they passed their initial shock, they started to respond with a small, moderately capable military, but sufficient to reverse the gains of the separatists. And the Russians went in force directly, using their own kind of combat power, mechanized formations, infantry formations, artillery, and a bunch of other stuff that the Ukrainians were not prepared for. And that resulted in more territorial seizures in Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, which are states, oblasts of states. And I would say at times a warm war, at times a hot war. So that takes us to today. Some 7 years later, you have a flare-up. And this is not a typical flare-up. There have been kind of flare-ups in violence, increased military activity along the line of contact, saber rattling, and so forth. But this is a somewhat unprecedented scale of saber rattling. The Russians have potentially shifted somewhere between 29 and 50 battalion tactical groups. These are kind of battalion plus formations, battalions. These kind of formations run from like 700 to 1,000 people. They're a mix of armor, infantry, a bunch of other stuff. And together, you know, their troop movements amount to somewhere between 25, 30,000 to maybe as high as even 50,000 troops being shifted around close to the border of Ukraine. And that's not just kind of that a limited stretch of border that's been contested in the Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts. This is actually troop movements into the Crimean Peninsula. There's a whole entire brigade, you know, thousands of troops being permanently resettled in Crimea. There have been troop movements that have been all along the Russian-Ukrainian border, and frankly, even through Belarus. There's some, it's not entirely clear, but there's been some deployments of Russian forces, which is odd because, you know, Belarus doesn't really want Russian troops on its territory either. But, you know, in the guise of like joint exercises, there are some troop movements in that general proximity, if not entirely in Belarus, right at that kind of tri-border region. And this is causing quite a bit of concern because the motivations for the Russians, you know, you could speculate and you could provide some informed speculation, but the Russians always want to be unclear and ambiguous. So it's troubling whether this is just simply signaling displeasure with the Biden administration, which has been critical, which has been showing greater support for Ukraine, which has kind of attacked Putin and his brand, undermining Ukraine and its aspirations for reforms and anti-corruption efforts, which were themselves undermined by a poorly executed policy between the Trump administration and Ukraine, but now look like they might be moving in the right direction. So to undermine that, to show weakness on the part of the Biden administration, there are numerous other potential scenarios. And then some practical ones, including the idea that Russia, in its annexation of Crimea, created quite a headache for itself because they annexed some territory that was wholly reliant on almost the entirety of its water supply. And at one point, its electrical power and gas, frankly, all of it kind of running through southern Ukraine. they've managed to shift some of that through this new bridge that they built across the Kerch Strait. So I think there's some certainly energy infrastructure, but they have not solved their water issues, which that could be, you know, a very practical benefit to conducting a limited military operation from Crimea to southern Ukraine. The more grandiose version of it would be kind of connecting that land grab with this kind of bit of territory that runs through Mariupol and just making it another kind of a land bridge, boxing the Ukrainian state out of the Sea of Azov and stuff like that. So there's all sorts of different interesting things at play, but I think that's a good quick intro, and maybe I'll pause and see what questions you have.
There's a lot of moving parts there. And there's one that you didn't mention, which I want to chat about too, which is that, you know, how much of this is a don't look now, Alexei Navalny may be dying, and if we can gin up a crisis somewhere else, maybe that will lessen the attention both within Russia and elsewhere on the Navalny situation. But let's start with this question of why now, and how much of this has to do with expressing displeasure with the noises coming out of the Biden administration. So the Biden administration takes office. It announces that Vladimir Putin is a killer. It makes nice to Ukraine in public in a way that Donald Trump certainly did not do. And it doesn't play ball with Russian conspiracy theories about, you know, obviously Hunter Biden and efforts to make Donald Trump look good. So should we understand this as principally a way of flexing muscle and reminding the Biden administration that Russia can, in a time of its own choosing, create an international crisis? You know, nice, stable Eastern Europe you've got there. Be a shame if something happened to it, kind of reminder. That's the first explanation that you mentioned. How much of this do you think is accounted for by that?
Sure. I think it's all of the above. And I definitely did not miss, you know, I think we should talk about Navalny. We should talk about the protests. We should talk about, you know, distracting from, you know, the completion and noise to block Nord Stream 2, all these things we could talk about in greater detail. But let's start with this idea of Russia's desire to be heard and to be recognized as a great power. And the fact that the Biden administration, minus, you know, harsh remarks on Putin himself and expressing both reluctance and, I'd say, casting a potential any improvement in relations as dubious at best, Russia wants to remind the United States, the EU, NATO, that it can be a disruptor whenever it wants to be. And it really doesn't take a lot. You know, we're talking about these troop movements that are practical and observable, but at the same time, you know, the Kremlin-controlled media is making all sorts of noises about, like, nuclear saber rattling and how they could wipe us off the map. These are things that are going on recently. The only thing I haven't seen is like exercises, civil defense drill exercises. That's when they really want us to pay attention. We'll see a civil defense exercise where, you know, people have to practice sheltering in place and stuff like that. You know, so that'll be in the menu of escalatory messaging options and stuff like that. There's a large scale exercise going on in the Arctic. And that's important because, you know, the Russians have slowly been building up their capabilities there. And in terms of the kinds of threats, you know, from a strategic standpoint that the Soviet Union posed, Russia wasn't in the same position to do that. But they're trying to demonstrate that they have the capability to kind of, you know, strike the United States from the North Pole. And there's no real effective defensive countermeasures for those kinds of things. So this is all also, I think, part of the messaging. The U.S. also took the opportunity after Navalny's arrest to sanction some Putin friends. And that probably, if anything, just indicates the appetite to do more of this kind of stuff, more meaningful sanctions. And the Russians like to settle the score. This is another way to kind of just say, okay, what else do you got? And then, you know, again, the more that the Russians are able to kind of get a reaction out of the U.S. and the West, the more Putin could continue to claim, you know, his relevance as a foreign policy leader, bringing back the greatness of Russia.
All right, so let's talk about the second component, which is the Ukrainian relationship itself. That is, there are contested regions now, as well as these areas that are essentially under so-called separatist control. How much of this is really about showing Zelensky and the Ukrainian government that, you know, there's a real limit to how much independence and anti-corruption muscle it can flex before the Russians show everybody who's boss in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that's a dynamic that Putin is and his regime is trying to spoil these efforts, because they recognize them as very difficult things to try to reverse. I mean, it would take years to try to potentially reintroduce. Well, I don't know. You could actually potentially make an argument that reversing anti-corruption is easier than one might think, Georgia potentially providing a useful template on how quickly things could get reversed. But I would say that those tend to be lasting changes. And once the population gets an appetite for transparency, the absence of corruption, you know, functioning government, not having to pay bribes. And there have been improvements at the kind of the person-to-person level. You know, police is not as corrupt as it used to be, which that's all relative, but it's still not as apparently corrupt. And the same thing, with regards to other institutions, I think large-scale corruption is still endemic. But I think those things are lasting changes that Putin's trying to interfere with, but he can't stop.
But if you're Vladimir Putin, you need Ukraine to be corrupt, right?
I think you need Ukraine, and in order to get Ukraine, you need Ukraine to be corrupt, because the trajectory right now is further slow, and with fits and starts and reversals, but a steady integration into the EU and into the Western liberal order.
Over time, it is clear that a majority of Ukrainians want integration into Europe. That's been demonstrated over and over again. Unless you buy off significant parts of the society, and the mechanism through which to do that is some combination of coercion and corruption, Ukraine will become a little bit too much like Poland, right?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the number of Ukrainians that have traveled into Europe and seen kind of an alternative vision of their future is massive. You kind of get a taste for the good life, and you don't want to go back. You don't want to go back to all sorts of issues that are associated with the Russian state, which is, we use the catch-all of corruption, but it's everything from kind of law enforcement violence to the inability to provide basic services, including healthcare, sufficient pensions for retirees. There's a whole bunch of things that can't be funded because corrupt practices siphon off resources that would otherwise pay for services, and focusing on kind of the regime elites that are keeping things on track. The Ukrainians sense that and will probably go out on the streets to prevent something like this happening.
And just to be clear, you're not a government minister in Ukraine. You're not the, like, say, the defense minister of Ukraine.
I would say that in that split second between when the offer was made and when I declined it, arguably I was the defense minister of Ukraine, right?
You were the defense minister designé.
Yeah, I mean, I in that split second, because it literally, there was no hesitation. But in that fraction of a moment between when I was offered the position and when I declined it, you know, should I put that on my resume? What do you think?
Yeah, I think probably better not.
Okay.
Anyway, so let's talk about a third element here, which you alluded to before, which is water. As I understand the water situation in Crimea, the vast majority of water comes through a canal, a sort of aqueduct system that has its sources in Ukraine proper, and the Ukrainians have basically shut it off. This is some miles into Ukraine, and there's some sense that the mustering of Russian forces is really at least somewhat about this Ukrainian shutoff of a very necessary resource to the Ukrainian peninsula itself.
Sure. I would start answering that question with a question of why now? Because this, in fact, has been an ongoing issue for years. The Ukrainians did shut off this canal system. The watershed for Crimea is in southern Ukraine. It's kind of a wetlands area, lots of lakes and stuff like that. But it's been shut off for years. And yes, in fact, the water supplies have been in a critical stage for multiple years now, maybe slightly more acute than in the past, because lakes have dried up. There have been severe droughts. But in reality, I don't know if that argument of providing water for the population of Crimea is particularly persuasive, because I don't think Putin cares. He doesn't really care that much I think there are bigger calculations in play. In my mind, the biggest one is basically, to push back on Joe Biden taking a tougher line with him and, potentially in Putin's conception, to the U.S. peril disregarding Russia. And he wants to kind of demonstrate that, he's not going anywhere. And he also wants to interfere with the issues, the kinds of reforms that Zelensky is potentially looking to undertake. Zelensky is going after oligarchs. The U.S. is helping by sanctioning oligarchs. Kolomoisky was probably the biggest, most relevant player in that regard, and eliminating vested interests or reducing the influence of vested interests or convincing the oligarchs that they have to play by the rules. It is one of the most important things that he could do, but it looks like it might move in the right direction. And Zelensky's been in power since 2019, and the U.S. has been rather disappointed with him not taking actions on this point. And then, you mentioned water as a potential reason for this flare-up. I think the internal issues that we've kind of touched on but deserve some additional time. Navalny and Putin's palace video has achieved enormous circulation in Russia. And it hasn't really had a, massive impact on kind of perceptions of the regime, just because a lot of people expected it. There has been a shift, if I recall correctly, I think it was like a 17-point shift on perceptions of Putin as a leader. Not in popularity, he still somewhere hovers in the 60s somewhere, or high 50s from what I'm seeing. But in terms of his credibility as a leader and whether he should continue to pursue further terms, and then the protests that occurred in over 140 cities across Russia, from north to south, east to west, and the appetite for the population to demonstrate their displeasure with the direction of the country through protests is something that Putin needs to manage somehow. And a tried and true formula has been this idea of consolidating support through external threats. There have been some interesting sayings about with external threats, the Russians will survive on like bread and water, to paraphrase one of them. So I think that's a issue that he's dealing with both internally and externally. I mean, he's still dealing with the fact that Belarus could easily spin off into a Ukraine-like orientation away from the Russian sphere of influence if protests, which have been going on for, some 9 months or more, continue. And, that's unclear. Let's just say when protests go on this long, it's hard to argue that either the people have the staying power, or Lukashenko, who's been in power for 25 plus years, is on the winning end of that equation. There's unrest in Central Asia. There's unrest in longer standing issues preceding Navalny in the Far East, and protests in Khabarovsk like some 6 months ago. So there's a lot of issues that he's dealing with, and there's discontent over a basic lack of services, falling living standards, inability to kind of for people to earn sufficient wages to pay for basic necessities, letting alone the comforts that were implicit in this bargain between the population staying out of politics and Putin providing, you know, the good life for the middle class. That looks like it's all kind of shattered. So there are many different reasons that he's looking for something, some way to shake up the dynamics that he's encountering.
So what has the United States done about this so far, and what should it do?
There's probably a number of things that I'd be speculating about that are going on behind the scenes. Top lines include coordinating with allies to make sure that we're on the same page, which it's unclear that we are, based on kind of the rhetoric coming out of like the capitals in Germany and France. You know, it's this false equivalency between Russians and Ukrainians both need to kind of de-escalate and all that kind of stuff, which is okay, except for the fact that the Ukrainians are not driving this flare up in hostilities. It's entirely the Russians. And I think that's, you know, they need to do that. Otherwise, they'll kind of burn their ability to engage in diplomacy with Russia. But it's still inappropriate, or at least in their perceptions, they think they need to do it. In reality, I think they need to take a harder line, like the United States is. It's the lack of strength that is encouraging Putin to take a more aggressive posture, not aggression emanating from the West. So that's one item, multilateralism. Another one is some significant messaging, and some of that's already coming out between the conversations between the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and his Kamchak, his Ukrainian counterpart, Secretary Austin and his counterpart having conversations indicating support, President Biden and Zelensky having conversations, NSA Sullivan having conversations with Andrei Yermak, the head of the presidential administration. You know, so those are all kind of good. Although it's possible, I just may have missed it, but I haven't seen that much from state, which tends to play kind of a pretty, you know, critical role in these kinds of messaging engagements. But it's possible that they're saving that particular engagement for the Russians. So, you know, he's managing the Russia angle, and other leadership is managing the, you know, support for Ukraine and organizing a multilateral approach. So those are kind of normal types of steps. Sanctions, kind of a normal step to take a look at in case of escalation. I think we should be thinking a little bit outside the box. And what I mean by that is we should be considering clearly messaging that escalation on the part of Russia in this conflict will result in a double down, triple down of support for Ukraine. So it's not going to have like a deterrence impact. It's going to have a magnifying impact on the, I think this year it's $300 million that's going in the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, pot of money, and there's more from state also. And what I mean by doubling or tripling down on support, that's engagements with Zelensky, that's support for reform efforts. Maybe there are things that we were trying to work on with regards to energy cooperation, economic cooperation. We should be looking at those to soften the blow of escalations and the subsequent shocks on the Ukrainian economy. But I also think we could be doing more with regards to military assistance. That means potentially offering the Ukrainians that have asked for more robust military equipment, that equipment.
Do you mean the more aggressive Russia is, the more goodies Ukraine gets? Which what you're describing is a publicly stated formula.
Yes.
And that we should be messaging the idea that the more aggressively Russia behaves, the more receptive we will be to more and more of Ukraine's wish list.
That is exactly right. We should be encouraging our Eastern European allies, Poland, for instance, who's been a big supporter, Turkey, you know, our frenemy at times, to provide more, potentially more equipment, you know, in the escalation of more goodies, encouraging our allies, maybe even with U.S. funding, to provide more equipment to the Ukrainians. The Poles have very capable anti-armor capabilities that they could offer. The Turks have some more, they're collaborating on UAVs, but lethal UAV capabilities. And then ultimately, you know, come in with the big stuff like US equipment. The Ukrainians have asked for like all sorts of different things, and as big as air assets, rotary wing air assets, to, you know, air defense capabilities, anti-armor capabilities. And Ukraine has made massive strides. It is a completely different military than the one the Russians managed them handedly in 2014. It's a skeleton force of some 70,000. I don't recall what it is now. It's well north of 200,000 now. And it's a trained and kind of seasoned force. So they've already made headway on their own, enabled with more capabilities, more exercises, which we actually already promised more exercises. That could make it even harder for Russia to try to flex its muscles in the future. You know, Russia is a multi-vectored threat, both on the ground from different avenues, Crimea, you know, Rostov Oblast, the northern kind of routes from Russia into Ukraine, but also these different ways to attack Ukraine through corruption, information operations, cyber operations, and all those types of things. We should help harden Ukraine against these types of threats. You know, I guess I'll leave it there.
And what do you understand to be, I mean, the new administration's receptivity to this approach?
I don't know if I have that much of an insight on the kind of my outside the box recommendation. I think that is one of those things that shouldn't be, you know, kept quiet. It should be public, and it should be roared as a way to kind of change the Russian calculus.
And they're not roaring it at this point.
No, they're not. I think there's a lot of feeling out on what they want to do with the Russia policy. They're going through the Russia reviews and China reviews and all these reviews that are going on. And they want to be more deliberate about it. I think the Russians are trying to get into the decision cycle and upend some of these reviews in a different kind of foreign policy, which marginalizes Russia, recognizing that there is little likelihood or need for cooperation. And it's mainly about kind of crisis management, deconfliction, and things of that nature. But, you know, I don't know, frankly, how far in they're leaning. But I think they are thinking about, you know, not necessarily the standard set of options based on how much support I understand they're you know, interested in showing for Ukraine.
I also think the idea that you're proposing could have the advantage of kind of jump-starting some of the Ukrainian side activity that we wanted to see 18 months, 2 years ago, but that sort of hasn't happened yet. And if you imagine a sudden, much more energetic U.S. engagement by way of making a very loud statement to Russia, you might actually have some beneficial impacts on the Ukrainian side.
Absolutely. I think the biggest misstep in the Trump administration was failing to seize the opportunity to help Zelensky implement his policies, which I believe in earnest he wanted to do, but he lacked kind of the strength, the kind of not necessarily even his own personal strength, although you could make that argument. I think it's just kind of the fighting the structures in Ukraine takes a lot of resources and relationships. And if he had U.S. support, he might have been able to make headway. Absent those, he couldn't. So yes, with increased engagement with the U.S., I think there's an opportunity to make headway on these agenda items that he wants to pursue. I think the bigger question for the United States might be, what does a focus on Ukraine and Russia mean for other geopolitical and other national security priorities, including, you know, the domestic issues that President Biden wants to deal with, everything from renewal of infrastructure to dealing, you know, with the COVID, number one on the list, renewal of infrastructure, the underlying causes of, you know, the rampant partisanship. And, you know, these fissures in society. And then, of course, foreign policy challenges like China and a resurgent. It's not assertive. They were resurgent from like relative power in the 18th century, but assertive power based on feeling the oats of massive economic growth, much more capable military, and where this kind of stacks up in those priorities. My argument would be Ukraine remains at the top of the list. And the reason that Ukraine remains at the top of the list, almost more important than, you know, minus domestic issues, is Ukraine is a enormous enabler for Russian power. I think we can muddle through with a status quo with China in this kind of current relationship. There's a coalescing of views with our allies on the kinds of threats China poses. China at times recognizes that its assertiveness has been counterproductive, and you could muddle through. But to lose Ukraine right now would be in a lot of ways a geopolitical game changer, because of this whole notion, and I think Zygmunt Brzezinski kind of said it best, is Russia with Ukraine automatically becomes a geopolitical power, an empire. Absent Ukraine, it's more of a marginal player. And I have this quote at the, here it is. It's worth saying it. It cannot be stressed enough that without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be an empire. But with Ukraine suborned and then subordinated, Russia automatically becomes an empire. So I think that's really one of the reasons we need to focus so heavily on Ukraine. And that's why, you know, being the director for Eastern Europe and Russia on the NSC, I saw little utility in working on the Russia issue, but great utility on working with Ukraine and, trying to improve the situation in Ukraine.
We're going to leave it there. Alex Vindman, thanks for joining us today.
I'm sorry, did you say minister? Or I didn't catch that.
Sorry, Minister Vindman. It's wonderful that you were able to take a few minutes out of your onerous duties in government to join us today.
No, Ben. Please, call me Alex.
See you soon.
See ya.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Share us on all the social media. Leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. And for heaven's sake, buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.